That gentle and lovely piece, Evening in Ararat Valley by Alexander Aratunian, played by Armin Guzelemian, my guest right here. Welcome back, Armin.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you, Vern.
And let's quickly trace so many aspects. We could take the whole hour tracing aspects of you, but let's start right out with your Armenian-ness. Were you born in Armenia?
I was born in Cairo, Egypt, into an Armenian family. Both sides of the family are solid Armenian all the way back.
And were they there because of leaving Armenia?
That is correct. Because of my maternal side, they were orphans as a result of the genocide. Mm-hmm. And they met actually in Cairo, my maternal grandparents. And so both my parents were born in Cairo.
Yeah. So sounds like you've had a lot of reasons throughout your life to really stay close to your roots.
And I'm very proud of them,
sure.
And especially now, yeah. I'm currently the chairman of the music committee of the Western Diocese of the Armenian Church, a position I never thought I would end up in, and the title, working very closely with the Archbishop, and it's very, very gratifying.
Yeah. Parenthetically, really quickly, the Armenian Church, is it essentially another branch of Christianity, like Eastern Orthodox,
it's
Roman
Orthodox.
Catholic, and it's
not
part of the Orthodox.
It's funny you should call it a branch. We were the first nation in the history of the world to assume Christianity as our national religion in 301 AD.
Wow. Anyway.
No, it is Orthodox.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Great. And so, continuing this idea, when you grew up in Cairo, did you live there a while, or did you leave?
Until I was 15 and a half.
So you got your musical roots in Cairo?
Only in terms of private lessons, not a formal education.
Mm-hmm. But the luck of a good teacher?
More or less. He was a very kind man, put it that way.
But you were involved enough to thrive anyway.
Yeah.
Involved enough with the idea of being a musician, of playing music.
At that time, I had no role models. My family didn't know what a professional musician was. So I didn't know that's what I'd end up doing the rest of my life. I knew I loved it and I had a talent. Yeah. It wasn't until I came to Los Angeles, actually, that all of that became clearer and clearer.
So was directly Cairo to Los Angeles?
No, with 1 year in Massachusetts, where I graduated from high school.
Okay, and then Los Angeles, where you still live.
Yep.
So that is your life and home.
It's
in
my
Los
base.
Angeles.
It's my
and
base.
So then, after you really found yourself musically in Los Angeles, what opportunities kind of came to you in that environment?
Well, the very first big one was the opportunity to make my debut at the Music Center with the LA Philharmonic, playing the Cacciatorian Piano Concerto with the composer in attendance. And that's an unforgettable moment. It was my first ever public appearance as a concerto soloist, rehearsal and a half.
About what year would that
1972.
Okay, and,
yeah.
so Cacciatorian...
Cacciatorian came, and he attended the rehearsal along with my piano professor of that time, Jacob Gimpel, and I couldn't have been more nervous. I don't think that has never been surpassed. And once I got through the rehearsal, the performance itself, I had no nerves.
But during the rehearsal, did he try to intervene or correct or change? Or
well,
did
he would
just
yell
listen?
A few things from the audience where he was sitting, and I got so scared thinking it was for me. It was inevitably for the orchestra and the conductor. But as we finished the rehearsal, he came up on stage and put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Why don't you and I go work for a little bit?"
Well, oh, perfect.
That turned into a 2-hour-plus session for a 7 o'clock performance
evening,
you know.
That's okay. You're young and strong,
right.
And you just do that.
Right, so it was a huge success.
Among other things, did he demand a really wide dynamic range?
That, and also he kept changing dynamics. He kept changing pedaling. He said, "I haven't looked at the score for 40 years. I'm just now getting ideas." And I said, "Maestro, I can only mix so many changes for 7 o'clock tonight."
And so that was a good early on thing. Now, when we think of you and the many things you've done in your life, you're not, if I may use the phrase, just a piano player.
Correct.
So talk about all the other musical interfaces you as a good pianist have been able to do.
Well, I got into the art of vocal partnership and chamber music partnership and collaboration. And it started out just as a simple elective class at UCLA that turned into something much more lifelong passion and also way of earning a living when the solo appearances are not quite, mm-hmm. you know. So people meaning agents and people in the business, have had a hard time dealing with how to classify them, which I'm proud of, but it doesn't make the business end of things easy.
Sure.
And this year is a perfect example. I made my Disney Hall debut playing the Dvorak Second Piano Quartet with members of the LA Philharmonic. In June, I made my debut with the Pasadena Symphony Orchestra with Michael Feinstein conducting on the opening night of the Pasadena Pops outdoors. That was a brand new experience.
Playing Gershwin or something like that?
No, Rustle of Spring, a souped-up orchestral version, and then another piece. And I'm here playing my first Elgar Piano Quintet, first Elgar anything. And then later on in December, I'm playing at the Dilijan Chamber Music Series in Los Angeles with Aida and Annika Vafian and Michel Zukovsky, the first clarinetist of the LA Phil, in a wonderful chamber music program. And in the meantime, I coach opera singers at home. So you tell me how you classify. Nice.
So the coaching opera singers at home is kind of your day job, as
correct,
it were.
Correct.
Yeah. And then.
But it has worked out that almost on every single chamber music appearance, not all of them, I get to play at least a sonata or a short piece, or mm-hmm. as I'm doing Sunday mm-hmm. afternoon, I'm playing a Haydn sonata in F major mm-hmm. before the Elgar Quintet.
Yeah. Yeah. Armin Guzlimian, who it is Sunday at 3 at the Fox, with the string quartet, Spokane String Quartet. And now, your relationship to Spokane, because you were here X years ago to play with the quartet, I know, 5 or 6, 7 years ago? Something like that, to play with the string quartet. Was that your first time here?
No, my relationship to Spokane goes way back, over 20 years, due to my connection with Bruce Ferdin and his connection with Nebraska Chamber Orchestra, with whom I played concertos. And I think the first performance I did in Spokane with the symphony, with Bruce conducting, was with the LA Vocal Arts Ensemble, which I was the co-founder and director of, and we did an All Sondheim evening. And so that started my connection mm-hmm. with Spokane, and then I was invited here as a judge for the Metropolitan Opera auditions. And as a result of my connection with Bruce, because of his death, I got to meet Sherry Knott and became very close friends. And this is my first time in Spokane without Sherry. I must say it feels very strange.
Of course it would. Well, it's a pleasure certainly having you back in our
I'm delighted.
In our area. And as you mentioned, you're playing Haydn and Elgar, and we'll get into that. Why don't we take a short break and hear you play some of the European music, mainline European music. Tell us a bit about this Beethoven Bagatelle we're about to hear.
Well, it's the one in E flat, and they're all very short, what shall we call them, character pieces, I guess you would say. They're not necessarily great virtuosic pieces. This one also happens to be quite lyrical, beautiful. I think it speaks for itself.
It has a high, I want one thing about it. It has a high opus number, and we have this whole shtick about early, middle, and late Beethoven. Is it characterized that way, or is it simply music?
The opus number reflects his maturity as a composer, I would say. But from this particular piece, it wouldn't necessarily be that obvious that it's a late piece. I don't think it's harmonically mm-hmm. so advanced as the Opus 32 Sonata or mm-hmm. anything like number 32 Sonata. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's just great music, great piano music.
Let's enjoy it. Armin Guzlimian playing this Beethoven Bagatelle. Thank you. Beethoven Bagatelle, played by my guest Armin Guzlimian, who is playing Elgar and Haydn with on the Spokane String Quartet concert. We have to specify that, because Armin, you said that you love, if you can, on a chamber music concert, to play some solo piano.
I do, and many quartets and chamber music organizations seem to be quite open to the idea. Not always, but it gives the quartet a break and it creates balance. And if I'm less known in the community, then they get to hear me play solo. It's a win-win on both sides.
And out of the entire range of piano repertoire, you know, Haydn kind of sits there in a secondary level. You know, we have all the, and I'm not saying quality-wise, but just in the world's perception. There's
it
Mozart,
is.
There's Beethoven, and, you know, and the Haydn piano concertos are almost unknown except for one of them.
But, you know, this may sound like heresy, but I almost like Haydn sonatas better than Mozart sonatas right now. I never thought I'd say that. In terms of the creativity, the wide variety of textures and pianistic challenges and colors and a very much wider range of expression and experimentation in the Haydn sonatas, I think it's the fascination is never ending for me.
And so is there any sense that that's a period of his life or something, or was he just always kind of that interest?
No, I think it's just reflective of the spirit, of his musical spirit. It was very mercurial and jovial and enthusiastic and high-spirited, and the sonatas really cover a very wide gamut of emotions and Haydn vocabulary.
So why have we sold him short, we, the musical world?
First of all, I don't see that much programming of his solo piano music on anybody's program. Horowitz used to play some. Ivo Pogorelich has played some. Of course, there are complete recordings of his complete piano sonatas, but that doesn't help the mass public that goes to concerts. So I think that may have something to do with it, because Mozart obviously occupies number one spot in that place.
Sounds like somebody should make an outrageous movie about Haydn and Esterhazy and the
Wouldn't
Prince,
that be
so
great?
So that there would be the counterpoint movie to Amadeus, and maybe he'd get a little more press.
Actually, this sonata was dedicated to Count Esterhazy, and I personally had the great experience of playing a chamber music concert in that one of the big rooms in the palace there in Esterhazy, way back when I was a student in Vienna.
Nice. And so that's one side of the musical expression you get to do. And then Elgar, how did that come about, to decide on the Elgar Quintet?
Well, the quartet and I were having conversations, and we were trying to find a piece that had not been performed in recent years.
And there's four or five piano quintets that keep getting played.
And last time I was here, we did the Dvorak E-flat piano quartet. And so it was suggested that we may concentrate on a more British character program. And so the Elgar came up, and I said, I've never played it. It's my first time. I think some members of the quartet have played it several years ago. It's a very lush, grand, passionate piece, very much in the sort of same niche as the Brahms Piano Quintet. And in fact, there are passages in the piano writing specifically, well, in the quartet too, that you think he's just stolen, just intact from the Brahms Piano Quintet. And Elgar refers to his piece as, it runs gigantically and in a large mood. He wrote this to Ernst Newman, the music critic of the Manchester Guardian, to whom the work is dedicated.
And so, Elgar, let's talk a little bit about his musical voice. You know, he is, for better or worse, two hit tunes, Pomp and Circumstance and the Enigma Variations. How do you kind of define Elgar's musical voice?
Well, it's one of the major British romantic voices, I think, and post-romantic, obviously. And I think I'm not familiar with enough of his music to make gross generalizations, but from this experience of doing the quintet, it's very symphonically conceived, the sonorities of the piano quintet. And in fact, when there was a quartet that was getting ready to do the first recording of the piece, they asked him to be the pianist, and he turned it down. He said, because I would play it so orchestrally that I would end up being the envy of all other pianists, so I'm not the right pianist for this. And then in 1925, eventually the first recording was made, and he was already quite ill and was almost on his deathbed, but they managed to get the master of that recording, and he heard it and approved it. So I would say it's an unabashedly lush, heart on sleeves kind of romanticism.
When was it written?
This 1918.
At the end of the war.
At the end.
Wow.
And it was premiered in 1919. He and his wife moved from London just after he turned 60. To a suburban summer home for the summer called Brinkwell's. And this is where he wrote Violin Sonata, String Quartet, and this piano quintet. And it was a very, very happy time for him. Mm. One of the really fascinating background information about this piece is the first movement. Lady Elgar has written about this. And there was a park nearby the house called Flexham. And there were the remains of these trees. There were trees that were very knotted and gnarled. And the myth is that those trees they represent the remains of Spanish monks who used to live on that property, who engaged in sacrilegious ceremonies and were struck by lightning because of their evil behavior.
Wow.
And there's even a Spanish dance that happens in the middle of the first movement, and it's Elgar himself refers to it as the unstilled regret for their evil fate. So you see, when I may mention this to the public on Sunday, just when you think there couldn't be a fancy, intriguing story about what sounds like abstract music, there definitely is. And Elgar referred to this first movement as ghostly still. And he obviously had a wonderful time doing it. And it's very appropriate being right before Halloween that mm-hmm. we're playing this first.
Well, and that's certainly the definition of romanticism, that it's about something.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nobody has verified it. If Lady Elgar wrote about it, there must be some, and she didn't just make it up. She also wrote in a correspondence that Edward was writing some really beautiful music, she wrote, when she heard this quintet come up.
Nice. So that's the big piece, the second half of the Spokane String Quartet concert on Sunday will be this Elgar Piano Quintet with my guest, Armin Guzzolemi. And thank you so much for coming back to Spokane.
It's a great pleasure, and may I add what an extreme pleasure it is to make music with my colleagues in the Spokane Quartet. The rehearsals are so engaging and so much fun that the performance is almost like the icing on the cake.
Oh, you know, one quick footnote. You said that there is a really great YouTube analysis of the Elgar.
There is, by Bruce Adolph.
It's whom we know from the Piano Puzzler.
Right. And it's one of his live lecture series. I believe it's on the East Coast. And he goes into measure by detail. So any listener that's hoping to come to the concert on Sunday, and even if you aren't, watch the YouTube and get to know this piece inside out so that it has much more meaning to you.
Great. YouTube, Bruce Adolph analyzing the Elgar Piano Quintet, which is the piece that Armin is playing with the Spokane String Quartet. Great. We'll have a wonderful time.
Thank you very much, Vern.
Let's go out with a little bit more of Armin's playing, returning to the Armenian Piano Music Album, returning to Alexander Aratunian and his Oriental Dance. That was music by Artunian, an oriental dance. I just kept Armin Guzelimin, the pianist, from walking out the door because I want you to describe to all of us about Komitas, who that was.
Komitas was his the name he was given when he became a priest. He was a musicologist that collected, he was a wonderful composer of liturgical music. He has his own transcription of the Orthodox liturgy, the Mass. But he went around the, all of Armenia and Turkish Armenia, the area, and collecting folk music materials. And he wrote very little piano music, but he wrote six dances for piano and then this... I think you're about to play the
Moshoshoror.
Mush is the name of a town, and Moshoshoror means dance of this town. This is a transcription by a later composer in the 70s by Andreasian. Komitas ended up going to Paris for the World's Fair at the beginning of the 20th century. Debussy and he met, and Debussy heard his music, was very impressed. And... with the horrors of the genocide and him losing whatever family he had, it affected him so strongly that he ended up his life in a mental institution. But he's considered the father of Armenian music by almost everybody. There are volumes and volumes of songs and vocal and liturgical music that he wrote.
Well, let's hear it, and thank you, Armin.
Thank you.